Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Ahmed Chalabi's death is making headlines. He died on Tuesday in Baghdad of an apparent suicide. Ahmed Chalabi is the man who convinced the United States to invade Iraq and spun lies about weapons of mass destruction, which the media published widely, especially the New York Times' Judith Miller. Today's guest, Hannah Alam, reports that perhaps no one is more responsible for persuading the U.S. to invade Iraq, whose faulty intelligence Bush administration war boosters used to sell Americans on an ill-planned invasion, whose legacy we see today in the Islamic State and the de facto partitioning of Iraq. Hannah Alam is a foreign affairs reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, which includes the Sacramento Bee. She's the paper's former chief bureau in Baghdad and Cairo. She just wrote a piece, "A Reporter Remembers Ahmed Chalabi, the Man Who Never Ruled Iraq." She knew him and interviewed him several times in Iraq. Hi, Hannah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And on Tuesday, voters in several states elected governors and mayors and voted on a variety of significant ballot issues. We often hear about big money being raised in the presidential election, but what about these state elections? Where is that coverage? Paul Blumenthal is a reporter with the Huffington Post. He covers campaign finance and money in politics. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on again.
Nice to have you. And in other big spending news, a Center for Public Integrity investigation has found that private charitable foundations led by Charles Koch have spent more than $19.3 million across 210 college campuses in 46 states. And Dave Leventhal reports that the Koch brothers used donations and key connections to amass clout on college campuses, and that money helps forward their political goal and build a talent pipeline of libertarian-minded students. Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Rose. Great to be back with you.
Good morning. Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Dave Leventhal, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there was a delightfully spooky story on the last page of The Economist. And if you're not familiar with the last page of The Economist, it's always an obituary, very appropriate given the day. This one was about Irwin Schiff, a man who I guess you could call a quintessential American story. He was a tax protester, lived an incredibly colorful life. If you don't know his story, you should definitely read it in The Economist. It's quite a bizarre tale of how he rose to prominence and became, to some, a complete rogue and to others a hero, based on the fact that he just decided he was never going to pay his federal taxes for decades on end. I can't give kudos to an exact author because The Economist do not sign their most of their articles,
right.
But kudos to them nonetheless for producing what was a fascinating read and week in and week out, one of the more interesting articles you're ever going to find in a magazine or a publication.
All right. Well, we'll find that one online. Hopefully it's online, and we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. That's Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And what about you, Paul Blumenthal? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I guess the story that I'm going to share is not exactly from this week, but I think it's from last week. It's a story from my colleague here at Huffington Post, Dave Jamieson, who covers the Labor Beat. And it's called The Life and Death of an Amazon Warehouse Temp. And it's really about a temporary worker in an Amazon warehouse in Virginia who died while working a shift. And tells the story of both his life, his death, and the conditions in warehouses that, you know, will ship you within 24 hours those late Christmas presents that you haven't picked out yet. I mean, I think it really cuts to the heart of what low-wage work is like in America these days and what people who are sort of on the cusp of having a full-time job, people who, you know, don't make it all the way through high school or just have a high school education in some of these suburban and exurban areas, the kind of work that's available for them.
This is a pretty long story. And over the years, the treatment of Amazon workers has gotten a lot of coverage. In fact, the LA Times had a piece recently about workers who are hoping to file a class action lawsuit. These are the workers who actually drive for the Amazon Prime service. And because they're contractors, they say that after they pay for their own gas and their bridge bridge toll, they're making about $9 an hour, and every single minute is calculated and watched very closely.
Yeah, and that's the same with their warehouse temps who, you know, work in these giant buildings picking out, you know, which product to put in a box to get to you within 24 hours. You know, their time is clocked, how many products they're able to ship, how quickly they move through the warehouse is all clocked and managed, and pretty much all of it, the temporary workers are done through, you know, temporary outsource firms like Insperity. I think that there's another case heading before the Supreme Court of Amazon workers who are suing one of these temporary working outsourcing contracting firms instead of Amazon, because that's who actually hires them.
And just quickly, Paul, has anything changed as a result of all of this reporting over the past couple of years?
I'm not entirely sure if anything has particularly changed. I think that there's a lot of attention to it. I mean, there was attention to Amazon's treatment of its white-collar workers, too, in a recent New York Times article.
Right.
As well.
Right. Okay, so kudos to Dave Jamieson, who wrote the piece, The Life and Death of an Amazon Warehouse Temp. Thank you for that. That's Paul Blumenthal. He's a reporter with the Huffington Post. And what about you, Hannah? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, so there's no shortage of stories about the atrocities committed by the Islamic State extremist group and its territories in Iraq and Syria. And a subgenre of that has been the enslavement of especially women, especially Yazidi Christian minority women. And a lot of that coverage has, you know, has been, well, I feel rather sensational. You hear a lot about jihadi brides, sex slaves, and to me that sort of dilutes the horror of what these women are experiencing. So there was a story just this week, maybe even just today, on the Daily Beast that I feel goes against the grain, and it's called The Portraits of the Yazidi Women Who Escaped ISIS. It's by a photographer, actually, Sevan Saliam, who covers the north of Iraq for the AP and works with Metrography, which is Iraq's first and only independent photo agency. And so she was able to interview a lot of these Yazidi women, took really haunting portraits of them. And so in its sparse treatment, just the portrait and the woman's own words without any sort of embellishment or other bells and whistles, to me it was stark, it was haunting, and powerful, even in a crowded field of such stories.
What did you learn about these women? I mean, there have been a lot of articles, as you've said, that have felt rather sensational about how women are treated. But what was it about this piece that stood out, and what stood out for you in the interviews that she did with the women?
Two things. The first is that, absolute resilience and courage of some very young women. I mean, we're talking teenagers. And the fact that they fought from the moment they were captured, in most cases, smearing dirt on their face and not washing so they'd to make themselves as you know, least attractive as possible to their captors, you know, conniving at all moments on how to escape, how to get away from these people, and how to bring as many people with them. So there was that, just the human resilience. And then also, you get this sense from the interviews of an underreported factor, which is that ordinary people living under ISIS rule helped the women escape in almost every single case. And so it was a Kurdish family, a taxi driver who, you know, she broke free, jumps in the taxi and says, please, please, I'm escaping slavery. And he said, I'll help you. Mm-hmm. And these are people who risk their own lives to help these women. In one case, it was the wife of the ISIS slave holder who took pity on the girl and helped her escape. So that, you know, the unsung people who are still trying to retain a sense of decency in really the vilest of circumstances, that really stood out.
Where do most of these girls live?
Well, now they've escaped. They're in, you know, Kurdish, the Kurdish north near Erbil.
Well, so kudos to this photographer, Sevan Saliam. Again, this is the Yazidi Women Who Escaped ISIS. And that is Hana Alam. She's a foreign affairs reporter with McClatchy Newspapers. And since you brought up ISIS, I just wanted to ask you, in terms of reporting on this, what are the challenges right now, Hana? And also, we just got word that McClatchy is going to shut down it's foreign bureaus, which is really bad news when you're talking about trying to get news out about women, for example, who are escaping ISIS.
Oh, well, sure. It was definitely a heartbreak to hear the, you know, corporate's decision to cut our foreign staff. I hope that won't be the end of all our foreign coverage. I mean, we will still be covering foreign affairs through national security beats, foreign affairs diplomacy beats, but, you know, there's just nothing like having the eyes and ears on the ground in those bureaus. And even though we had been, you know, cut quite extensively in recent years, the final death knell, you know, it was hard to take.
I'm sure. So what does that mean for you as a foreign affairs reporter?
Well, my beat still exists. It's a national beat, not a foreign beat. So I'm here in D.C., and I'll keep on keeping on until I'm given other orders.
And we've had Jonathan Landay on many times. He received awards for his coverage of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and sadly recently left McClatchy. But, you know, reading your piece about Ahmed Chalabi, I was thinking about the reporting that Jonathan Landay did, because some of the media critiques about Ahmed Chalabi and the information that he gave specifically to Judith Miller of the New York Times, that's now getting some more attention. But before we dive in and talk about that, why don't you first remind us of the role that Ahmed Chalabi played in the invasion and occupation of Iraq? Again, he died on Tuesday of a heart attack in his home in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think quite simply put, had there been no Chalabi, not sure there would have been an invasion. He was the chief lobbyist. He was the Iraqi face. He was the American supplier of the intelligence they sought and needed to justify an invasion. So, I mean, he was really a linchpin in all of this.
And he was the main source for a lot of media outlets about weapons of mass destruction. Can you remind us again what he told people about WMDs?
Well, he provided many of the sources who would go on to talk about mobile weapons labs and all these this stockpile of weapons and so on and so forth that, of course, we now know were never discovered by any weapons inspectors who were able to go in. So he would maintain that, hey, I provided the sources, American agencies, it's up to you to vet them. And, you know, others would definitely say he was a con man. He sold bogus, faulty intelligence. So, you know, that's but without a doubt, I mean, he was the source of much of that faulty intelligence. And, you know, he certainly gets a lion's share of the blame in that, although I think that I agree with somebody on Twitter wrote this week, you know, there's an awful lot of Americans duped by wily foreigner. That's sort of a trope in the coverage about Chalabi. And I do think that's unfair. I think, yes, he provided incorrect information, patently false information, sources who were very dubious to say the least. And but he, you know, I'm not sure that excuses the entire war machine of the Bush administration that really was eager to have that sort of cover. And by the way, ignored CIA warnings about Chalabi.
Right.
So, you know, I think it was that both interests dovetailed to this invasion.
And Paul Blumenthal, Ahmed Chalabi's death is getting attention in the media. What do you think about the coverage of his legacy and the very close relationship he had with the Bush administration?
What do I think about Chalabi's role?
Well, the coverage of it, because now that he passed away, that he's back in the news. And so how is that being covered and his legacy and the role that he played in the decision to invade Iraq?
I mean, I think that there's, you know, a mix of coverage. There are people who touted him back in, you know, the early days ahead of the war and leading into it, who are sort of apologizing for his role, or not really apologizing, but kind of deflecting it. I mean, I think that there's a lot of interesting coverage related to this, and also to discuss what kind of role the Bush administration and the people who actually made the decision to follow through on the bad intelligence that Chalabi was providing should what we should provide to them, whether it's any kind of absolution of their role.
And Dave, what about you? What are your thoughts on how this is being covered, how it should be covered?
I think a lot of people have just simply forgot about him. Wouldn't be a household name that most people are even going to recognize at this. And perhaps that's because news coverage in general has moved so far beyond the conflict in Iraq, the Iraq War, and everything that happened in the aftermath. To provide a shameless plug for the founder of the Center for Public Integrity, Charles Lewis, he wrote a book about this last year called 935 Lies, which is really just an incredible takedown and also an explanation of sort of the consistent year after year drumbeat of the misinformation that came out in the aftermath of the war beginning from government sources all the way up to President Bush about why we were involved, how the United States was managing the war, what the goals were, et cetera, et cetera. And if anything, that will be, in a way, the ultimate refresher course, although it may ruin your day, too, in the process of exactly what happened and whether it's Chalabi or any of the other characters in the mix, the effect that they had, too, on being able to steer the United States in a direction that we're still in to some degree as a result of decisions made last decade back in 2002 and 2003 and beyond.
And Hannah, Eric Bollert with Media Matters wrote about this and said, reminded people who was Ahmed Chalabi, the influential Iraqi politician who served as the main source of bogus information that former Times reporter Judith Miller used in her discredited work about Iraq's supposedly brimming stockpile of weapons of mass destruction. She's now a Fox News contributor. And, Eric Bollert goes back to the Times in 2004 when the executive editor, Hal Raines, wanted to prove the paper's conservative critics wrong by printing this information. How important do you think it is to continue to go back and look at what the media got wrong in the lead-up to the U.S. invasion?
Well, I think in the context of any sort of intervention in Syria, it's very important. Often you hear the State Department worries that people had overlearned their lesson in Iraq, so therefore did not want to support regime change in Syria for fear that it would become another quagmire like Iraq. And others who thought, no, we've underlearned the lessons of Iraq by, once again, backing exile groups with little constituencies and plunging into a place where we don't really have a lot of intelligence or assets on the ground.
And as you write, that perhaps no one is more responsible for persuading the U.S. to invade Iraq, whose faulty intelligence Bush administration war boosters used to sell Americans on an invasion whose legacy we see today in the Islamic State. So do you feel that with the reporting on Chalabi, that the reporters are making the connection to what people are dealing with today with ISIS?
Well, I think people know, people who follow ISIS in the Middle East, that now it's an accepted fact that, of course, al-Qaeda in Iraq, the early incarnation of ISIS, sprang from the chaos left by the security vacuum in Iraq after the invasion. And certainly one of the biggest contributors to the insurgency was de-ba'athification, not only just dismantling the entire army in one fell swoop and therefore sending out thousands of disenchanted young Sunni and other men right into the ranks of the insurgency recruiters. That's de-ba'athification was across all levels, and that was Chalabi's pet project, that not only it wasn't enough to have the figurehead Saddam and his close allies removed, he wanted a wholesale purge of Ba'athists, and that was supported by Paul Bremer and others in the U.S. administration, and we are reaping the results of that right now. Mm.
And Hannah, before we let you go, what are you working on right now?
Today I'm working on Yemen and, the U.S. role in that conflict, supporting Saudi Arabia with weapons deals and targeting intelligence and other things, just taking a closer look at what the U.S. is doing in that conflict.
Hannah Alam is a foreign affairs reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, which includes the Sacramento Bee. She's the paper's former bureau chief in Baghdad and Cairo. Hannah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And you can find her reporting at yourcallradio.org. And we'll also put this piece by Media Matters, The New York Times, Chalabi's Iraq, and GOP Cries of Liberal Media Bias at yourcallradio.org. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Paul Blumenthal. He's a reporter with The Huffington Post covering campaign finance and money in politics. Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And if anything stood out for you in the news this week, we'd love to hear from you. We are going to talk about money in the recent elections. We'll also talk about Dave's piece about the Koch brothers contributing to universities across the country. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. So let's dive in and talk about money in politics. Money in the presidential election is getting a lot of attention, but money in state elections is not getting much attention. And Paul, one of your recent headlines was, your state and local elections are now a super PAC playground. So what really stood out for you this last election? What stood out for me is the Supreme Court race in Pennsylvania. It was the most expensive Supreme Court race ever. That's what I've read. It was a $15 million race, and three Democrats won that one.
That was a pretty big race, and you know, there's been a lot of attention recently to the amounts poured into these judicial races across the country, which really, you know, a lot of studies have shown that the money that comes into these races really does affect the outcome of cases. I mean, you have in a lot of states and counties, you have courts that are where the judges have to run for election, and they're funded largely by lawyers and industry groups who, you know, have a lot of business before them. And, you know, it's a huge conflict of interest problem. And, you know, the Supreme Court has actually even ruled that outside money spent through, you know, a nonprofit or another kind of political action committee can actually lead to the corruption of justices there, and in a particular case, Caperton v. Massey in West Virginia. The Supreme Court cases stand out a lot, but also in the elections that happened last week in 2015, I don't know if a lot of people know that. I know in San Francisco you guys had an election, but a lot of places across the country do not have elections on off years, and so might not pay attention to the local races that do. But in Kentucky, Louisiana, there were gubernatorial races that featured high-profile spending by super PACs, these outside groups that can raise unlimited sums from corporations, unions, or wealthy individuals. And then we even saw super PACs involved in assembly races in New Jersey, legislative races in Virginia, and even far lower down, small-town mayoral elections or city council elections. So I think that, you know, what we're seeing, and this isn't necessarily new this election cycle, we saw it in 2012, 2014, is that the Supreme Court Citizens United decision and subsequent lower court decisions that expanded the right of corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals to spend freely in elections is really not just about what we see at the presidential level, but also trickles down to races where, you know, $100,000 really actually means something to that election and really can influence the outcome and influence, you know, what kind of policies get talked about from the people who are elected.
And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue talking about how super PACs affected this week's election. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
If you'd like to join in today's conversation on the Weekly Media Roundtable, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, this week's presentation of Inflection Point with Lauren Schiller, and then at noon today, it's the Tavis Smiley Show here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with Professor Cecilia Tichy about her new book, Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. Jack London has long been hailed as a prolific producer of best-selling fiction, but Tichy argues that he also deserves recognition as one of America's foremost public intellectuals, who was a champion of progressive causes. So what do you know about Jack London? That's coming up on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. We're speaking with Paul Blumenthal, a reporter with the Huffington Post covering campaign finance and money in politics. Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. And in just a bit, we will talk about his major investigation looking at the Koch brothers' contributions to universities across the country. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on media coverage of money in politics, but not just the presidential election? We're also talking about money being poured into state and local elections. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Dee in San Francisco. Hi, Dee. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
When I heard that NBC had decided who could not run, not be part of the debate, it again reminded me that I wonder where all that big money that's spent on elections goes. And it seems to me that a lot of it is going to the media because you pay for time on the media. And so my question is, what information is there on how much money goes to the media from the political campaign?
It's such a great question, Dee. In fact, two campaign finance initiatives passed in Maine and Seattle, and we noticed that they didn't get much attention. So, Dave Leventhal, first off, what are your thoughts about all of the money that's being spent and raised by politicians? How much of that money is given to the media for commercials, for example?
A significant amount, and it's a moving target. What we would say at this moment would change by this afternoon, just by virtue of the constant spending that is taking place. What we can tell you is this, is that we analyze television ads very closely at the Center for Public Integrity. Already you have certain campaigns, but most notably the super PACs, as Paul said, the outside organizations that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money to advocate for or against a candidate. In some cases, these groups have already been airing thousands upon thousands of television ads just to support presidential candidates alone. And we're not talking here about state races. We're not talking about congressional races. And here we are about a year from Election Day, and already you have all of these ads that are flooding the airwaves, particularly at least at the presidential level, in states like Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada to some extent, many of the early states that will conduct their presidential nominating contests in February or going into early March. But what we can definitely see, at least looking from what happened in 2012 and extrapolating to 2016, is that this is a multi-billion dollar affair, where television stations and media properties, even if we can't put an exact dollar figure on it, certainly they stand to benefit to a great degree. And one thing that's often not well known is that presidential candidates or political candidates, they usually get the lowest available rate every time they put an advertisement on television. So whatever the bottom ground floor rate is for putting an ad on whatever it is, television station, it might be prime time, it might be overnight, regardless, they're going to get the lowest rate. Super PACs, however, that's where the real money comes in for the television stations, because they can effectively soak the super PACs, and the super PACs oftentimes will even have the money to be soaked, if you will, and they're going to pay a much higher rate, typically speaking, than the candidates' committees themselves will.
So have you looked at how all of this money is affecting the network's coverage of money in politics?
We haven't looked very deeply at that specific issue. Definitely you'll hear from people on the left who will say it is definitely skewing the way that candidates are covered. You'll hear from people on the right saying the exact same things, although going in an opposite direction. So there is definitely that that sense from certain partisans, both conservative and liberal, that this kind of money is having some kind of an effect. Can you quantify that? It's very difficult. And also, too, I know plenty of journalists, I know Paul does too, who work in television, who do great work, are very conscientious, would rather quit than be told how to cover a candidate in a certain way. So there's definitely that kind of countervailing element to it all. But it's definitely more a concern and certainly at the forefront of people's minds, perhaps a bit more in a situation like this when we just simply have so much money pouring into the system and so much at stake with the dollar amounts being raised, that these are questions that are certainly going to come up and perhaps legitimately come up too.
And Paul, what are your thoughts? How do you think all of the money spent on TV ads affects coverage of money in politics?
You know, I'm not terribly sure how much it actually affects it. I agree with Dave. I think it's really hard to quantify that and to know how much, you know, like if there's actual pressure from an executive level in, you know, the advertising department onto the actual editorial product that's being put out there. You know, I just think it's almost impossible to figure that out. I mean, I think that we know that, you know, news departments certainly do have pressure from above as it relates to advertisers and other kind of partners that they're engaged with and how they might cover them. I don't know if that plays a role in who is or is not included in a debate for these presidential races, but there certainly is a lot of money going into television stations. However, the most of it isn't really going into the sort of the large networks and cable stations, but really to local networks. And so you get sort of like a local network in Boston that has coverage of New Hampshire, places in Des Moines, Iowa, where a lot of the early spending is happening. And those are the places that really see a windfall of cash, especially, as Dave said, from all of the super PAC spending that we're seeing, since they don't have to, you know, they don't have to cut them a lowest rate. You know, they can charge them exorbitant fees to put on a primetime ad.
Well, you have to wonder. I mean, the New York Times came out with an explosive investigation a couple of weeks ago about the 158 families who've contributed half the money raised for the 2016 campaign. Most of it went to Republicans. I mean, we're talking like tens of millions. And then the $1 million contributions went to Hillary Clinton. And I was kind of shocked because I didn't see that piece talked about at all on the cable shows. I mean, I don't watch all of them, but the little that I have watched, it just didn't get covered at all. Dave, are you familiar with that New York Times piece? And were you surprised?
Read.
Yeah, it just didn't get much traction.
Read it about a dozen times back and forth. It's required reading for anyone who cares about this particular issue, money in politics, or just simply cares about the way that the country is run writ large. It speaks very much, Rose, to the notion that a lot of folks you hear from, particularly among Democrats who are concerned that this country is going to be run by an oligarchy, or at least the politicians are going to be associating with a very narrow, specific class of people who can help them financially in their campaigns. You know, that is something that I suppose has been a concern in politics for all the way back to the days of Tammany Hall and whatnot. But in the here and now, with campaigns are an omnipresent part of our lives for all intents and purposes, the permanent campaign is not a fantasy; it's a real thing. And there is regardless of what side of the political aisle you're on—Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, up, down, left, right. The fact of the matter is Democrats and Republicans, particularly office holders, are spending more time with very, very wealthy people who oftentimes have very specific special interests of their own to fundraise with them, to campaign with them. They are the ones, the very wealthy, who are going to get their phone calls returned, are the ones who are going to get access to the candidates. And it just speaks to a sort of larger notion of, is this right? Is this the best way for us to run our country? Again, many Democrats would say, no, it's not. But also, too, you get some Republicans even who are making the case that this is just not a healthy thing. We have to think as a country, as Americans, about is there a better way? And in part, there's been a bit of a backlash. I know we can't go on forever about this issue, but the notion of Donald Trump and his ascendance in the Republican primary, and why is he doing so well, and why are the establishment candidates doing so poorly? Well, there are probably lots of reasons for that, but one thing, Donald Trump, love him or hate him, he's making the point constantly over and over again. He says, I am not going to be bought by billionaires. I am a billionaire. I am my own super PAC. I hate super PACs. And that, to some degree, is resonating with people in a way that it kind of gives him perhaps a little bit of a populist edge relative to a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio and some of the other candidates who are relying very heavily on the money from big dollar donors, super PACs, even nonprofit organizations to some degree that don't even have to disclose where their money is coming from, yet have the ability to go and advocate for and against candidates post the Citizens United decision of 2010 that the Supreme Court brought down that really changed the game in a profound way as far as elections are concerned and the way that elections are waged.
And Donald Trump probably couldn't pay for all of the free media attention that he's getting. That's also, I think,
another factor.
And we should say, we just got word that Bloomberg TV has been covering money in politics, and also the reporter of that New York Times piece about the 158 families, and they did name names, was on MSNBC Chris Hayes' show. So I just want to put that out there. And thank you for calling in with that information. If you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about how money in politics is covered, how was it covered in this last election? Today's guest, Paul Blumenthal, reports that super PAC spending on state and local elections often has more of a direct influence on government than spending on the more talked about 2016 presidential election. We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Paul Blumenthal is a reporter with the Huffington Post. Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. So, Paul, what else specifically can you tell us about the last election and all of the money that was spent? You report that some groups raising unlimited sums for Kentucky's gubernatorial race, including the ones involved only in the primary election, collected more than $14 million, and those involved in Louisiana's election have pulled in more than $16 million. And in Kentucky, another Tea Partier was elected governor, anti-choice, anti-Planned Parenthood, anti-Obamacare, and pro-vouchers. Even a lot of Republicans there didn't think he was going to win because he's so extreme.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an interesting race and quite an interesting situation. The, you know, incoming governor, Matt Bevin, ran against Mitch McConnell in a primary in 2014 and lost, you know, as a Tea Party candidate. And now he's going to be the governor all of a sudden. It's kind of, I think, surprising to a lot of people. Maybe not terribly surprising if you look at sort of how the partisan polarization in this country is gone, where, you know, Kentucky is pretty much a red state at the federal level, hasn't been at the state level. But, you know, I think that the polarization in this country kind of makes it that, you know, no matter who is nominated, it's going to go to a Republican now. But there was quite a lot of spending on both sides of the aisle from super PACs. In that election, labor unions putting a lot of money through a super PAC to support the Democratic candidate, Jack Conway, and most of the money to support Bevin came from a super PAC funded by the Republican Governors Association, which has really only disclosed about 6 months worth of its fundraising from this year. So a lot of the money that was spent we won't really know about until January, which is somewhat problematic from a disclosure standpoint. And then in Louisiana, you know, there was a lot of spending from all of the candidates from super PACs, but particularly Senator David Vitter, who has advanced to a runoff as a Republican that will be held in later in November. You know, he started a super PAC very early on and started raising money for it and transferring money from his federal campaign account to be able to spend that money in the state election. And a lot of the contributions that have gone to it, which I think is an important point, are people who will have business before him if he were to become governor. You have MCNA Healthcare, which is a contractor for the Louisiana's Children's Health Insurance Program and administering Medicaid. You know, they run the dental program and have a contract for that down there. They contributed $100,000 to his super PAC. And, you know, that contract will eventually come up and will have to be renewed. You know, you have other people, Chenier Energy donated $125,000. They recently received, you know, $1.7 billion in property tax relief through incentives provided by the government. So you have a lot of these businesses that get tax incentives, get contracts from the governor's office, from the legislature, that, you know, could come up if he were elected.
And that is Paul Blumenthal. He's a reporter with the Huffington Post covering campaign finance. Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And Dave, you just wrote about the Koch brothers' contributions to universities. Before we talk about that, in a Denver, Colorado suburb, voters recalled three conservatives on the Jefferson County School Board. And the Washington Post reports that the Americans for Prosperity PAC, which was created by the Koch brothers, contributed heavily to make sure that these board members were not recalled. $1 million was spent in this Denver suburb, but the voters did recall these conservatives.
When we think of the Koch brothers and many big-time political patrons, both conservative and liberal, you oftentimes will think of it and think of them in the context of federal campaigns. But as Paul has been discussing, and also is true in much of the local reporting that we see from city council races and city hall races and, in this case, school board races, you have national entities that are more and more seemingly encouraged by the ability for them to play big in smaller races to do exactly that, to oftentimes go in and spend incredible amounts of money for what would seem to be a very low-dollar affair in order to sway the outcome of it. So, you know, at the federal level, when we talk about big money in politics, both sides kind of have the bomb, if you will. They have the ability to marshal big, huge, crazy amounts of money, and in a way, it becomes trench warfare, to extend the metaphor a little bit. But at the local level, it still is a very different game, where one side may have no money at all, the other side can come in with $1 million, and all of a sudden you have an entirely different race than it would be otherwise. Expect this to be, so long as the law stays the way that the law is right now, expect this to be something that we're going to see, for better or for worse, more frequently in the future.
What are your thoughts overall about how the media reports on the Koch brothers? One of the Koch brothers, I think it's Charles, he's out with a new book, and Morning Joe host Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski did a very long sit-down interview with him, and Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid ripped into their interview, saying it was a propaganda campaign with very softball questions. And he did this he took to the Senate floor to rip on Morning Joe for this Koch brothers interview. What do you think about how the national media cover the Koch brothers?
Well, I definitely heard Harry Reid talk about this, and he was very critical of both MSNBC and the media writ large when it comes to their coverage of the Kochs. I think, with all due respect, what the leader forgot was some fantastic interviews that have been done with Charles Koch. I think of one that Kai Ryssdal did on Marketplace, which I thought was a very insightful and pointed interview with Koch. And a lot of questions that were very hardball as opposed to softball. And other interviews that have been done, too, not only with the Kochs personally, but also about the Koch brothers, about other patrons, political patrons, whether it's Tom Steyer or some of the other big-time folks on the Republican side, Sheldon Adelson, et cetera, et cetera. So one thing that I think, to directly answer your question, at the national level, is that there are more media outlets that have people who are dedicated to covering political influence issues, be that lobbying or Money and Politics. Paul's at Huffington Post. There are people at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, all of the Hill publications, Politico, where I used to work, Center for Public Integrity, ProPublica on the nonprofit side. When you add it up together, I can think of off the top of my head at least 15, 20 reporters who this is kind of what they do. That really wasn't the case several years back, and it's good to see that at least media properties in general are investing in good reporters who know the area, who know the topic, and are willing to ask tough questions and be very straight down the middle with the reporting. Let the facts lead where they will.
Well, and your reporting, your recent piece, Koch Brothers Higher Ed Investments Advance Political Goals, this was based on information that you got. It's an analysis from IRS tax filings, and you found that during 2013, a pair of private charitable foundations, Charles Koch Leads and Personally Bankrolls, combined to spread more than $19.3 million across 210 college campuses in 46 states and the District of Columbia. What are they spending this money on?
They're spending this money almost exclusively on economic programs at colleges and universities, specifically free market style economic academic programs, it's very different than what we have found with most other big time political donors. To back up just one step, the reason why we wrote this story in the first place was at the ground floor, based on an analysis that we did of all of the biggest political donors, Democrat and Republican, in the United States for 2014. And we wanted to ask the question, okay, well, we know that they're donating a heck of a lot of money to super PACs and to political candidates, but what are they doing with their money elsewhere, particularly in higher education, which is, of course, one of the most fertile proving grounds for people who will ultimately go and one day reach political power or be involved in the government. And what we found in doing that analysis is that Charles Koch, the Koch brothers with their charitable foundations, were number one when you looked at the private foundations that are controlled by political donors, the political donor class at the very high level. So had that been, you know, George Soros or another type of political donor, we would have written a story about them, but the Koch brothers were certainly number one by this measure. And what we did from there was effectively try to answer the question of, well, what are they trying to get for their money? What's the plan here? Why are they so adamant about investing in colleges and universities across the country in a very particular way? And what we were ultimately wrote in the story was that by the words of Koch officials, we used audio tape of a meeting, you know, back in 2014, where the Koch Foundation effectively laid out its strategy to top donors. And by their own words, they said, we're trying to build a talent pipeline. We're trying to go from the academy, from the classroom, to the halls of political power, and make sure that we have integrated all of the areas of our network that we fund, that we bankroll, be them academic or, for that matter, political. They see it really in one single arena, where the investments that they make in the futures of an 18 or 20-year-old right now will pay them dividends in the future when that student goes to one day lead a political organization or perhaps becomes a congressman. And it's all very much based on the Koch philosophy for the way that economics and the economy and finance should work in the United States.
You report that the money helps for their political goals and builds a talent pipeline of libertarian-minded students. At the College of Charleston in South Carolina, documents show the foundation wanted more than just academic excellence for its money. It wanted information about students it could potentially use for its own benefit. It sought, for one, the names and email addresses of any student who participated in Koch-sponsored class, reading group, club, or fellowship. So when the students take part in these classes, do they know that they're sponsored by the Koch brothers?
Oftentimes they don't. And we talked to many students for this story. Some of them were shocked to hear what we had found, considered it to be downright spooky and even unethical. Some, you know, weren't bothered by this, being them students or other people, to say, look, there are plenty of people who are very wealthy, who donate to colleges. Many of them are liberal. Nobody's going to say for a second that colleges and universities are overwhelmingly conservative. On the contrary, they are overwhelmingly liberal in many people's opinion. So one argument here is that the Koch brothers are providing sort of an elixir to the left-leaning college and university system in this country. Okay, you can make that argument. But as you just read from the story, this is something that seems to be a little bit different. And we have found in our reporting and report in the story that oftentimes there are certain asks, there are certain strings attached, be them thin strings or thick strings, that really will allow the Koch Foundation to have some certain measure of control over the way that the money is being used. And even I think Florida State University would be a good example where over the years they've sought very specific strings and tried to attach very specific strings all the way up to the hiring of certain professors. So no, students don't seem to be very aware of who's funding their education at all. They know they're paying tuition. They know that there's money coming out of their pocket. They don't necessarily know that the Koch brothers or anyone else are intimately involved sometimes in the classes that are being sponsored at a university. And as you alluded to a moment ago, this is happening very much across the country. The bulk of the Koch brothers' resources are going to a particular school in Virginia, George Mason University, and a couple of research centers that are there. But there are 46 different states in the United States and the District of Columbia that have a college that has received Koch funding. And that's a number that has been growing and growing and growing to the point of where it is today over the years. 10 years ago, we'd be having a very different conversation. It just wasn't the case that this was so widespread.
Well, it's an in-depth investigation, and thank you for writing this. The piece is Koch Brothers Higher Ed Investments Advance Political Goals. Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And you can also check out Paul Blumenthal's important piece about super PAC spending on state and local elections. Paul is a reporter with the Huffington Post covering campaign finance. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Professor Cecilia Tisci about her new book, Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America. Jack London has long been hailed as a prolific producer of best-selling fiction, but Tisci argues that London also deserves recognition as one of America's foremost public intellectuals who was a champion of progressive causes. What do you know about Jack London? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihei Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.